Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of Morbidology. I'd like to take a second to thank my new Patreon supporter, Ive Genshagan. In return for your support on Patreon, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, ad-free and early release episodes, true crime articles, polls, and you can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. The support on Patreon truly helps out, and I am eternally grateful. Also, as some of you already know, I've been working on a new investigative true crime series called The Shattered Window. It's a 10-part podcast on the murder of Jacqueline Dwallaby, and we've been working alongside some of the people involved in the case. I'm about to play the promo for The Shattered Window, and the introduction is already available across all podcast platforms. Please go and check it out and make sure to subscribe. The murder of Jacqueline Dwallaby is a tragedy that has puzzled and polarized the minds of those who know it. Over the past 6 months, we've extensively investigated this case, trawling through files, trial transcripts, and archives, and have been conducting interviews with the people who lived through it.
It was a sensational, startling fact that a 7-year-old little girl had shown up missing from a suburban home.
Something like that happening would have never crossed our parents' minds.
The notion that a stranger can slip into a child's bedroom in the middle of the night, completely undetected, is surely a notion that every single parent on this earth fears. But what's even more lamentable is knowing that a child killer is roaming the street, and even more chilling, they could be someone you know.
Hosted by Emily G. Thompson and Eileen McFarlane, this is The Shattered Window. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Summerfield is a small town just south of Ocala in Florida. In April of 2015, a man living in Southeast 53rd Avenue had been sitting on his porch late at night when he saw a boy fleeing from his neighbor's home. He saw a number of other youths quickly run out after him, punch him, and drag him back inside. What he thought was a typical teenage beatdown would turn out to be one of the most brutal crimes the area had ever seen. Seth Jackson was a 15-year-old boy living with his parents in Bellevue, Florida. Seth had grown up in the Bellevue Hills Estate Mobile Home Park, where he loved nothing more than hanging out with the neighborhood kids, as well as his older brothers, Scott and Stephen Jackson. Quite often, they would go to Mama Sue's house for snacks or soda, or just to hang out. Mama Sue had 5 boys and 1 daughter, and all of the neighbourhood kids used to cram into her home. Her son Luke said, he used to come over to the house and we would play in the dirt and swings. Those who knew Seth said that he was bright and spunky and always did well in school. He was always the joker of any group and always had a hilarious comeback. His friend Jesse said that they loved skateboarding, BMXing and climbing trees, and as they got older, they enjoyed playing paintball. There wasn't anybody in the neighbourhood that had any negative memories of Seth. According to his parents, Scott and Sonia, he loved making people laugh and was an animal lover. His ultimate ambition in life was to become an ultimate fighting champion, and when he turned 18, he was planning on enrolling in professional training. On the 18th of April, 2011, 15-year-old Seth Jackson was reported missing by his concerned parents. According to his parents, they had not seen him since the day before, and there was no chance that he was a runaway. Just 2 days after his disappearance, it was revealed that Seth's remains had been discovered, and that 5 people had been arrested and charged with first-degree murder. They were 16-year-old Kyle Hooper, 15-year-old Amber Wright, 20-year-old Justin Soto, 18-year-old Michael Bargo, and 19-year-old Charlie Ely. 37-year-old James Havens, who was the stepfather of Kyle and Amber, was additionally arrested and charged with accessory after the fact to first-degree murder. According to investigators, James had helped the teenagers dispose of the body and evidence, and helped 2 of the teenagers flee from the area. The arrests came as a massive shock to the locals. The murder was extremely heinous, and for a group of teenagers to be charged with it was just unbelievable to a lot of people.
The details is gross. You don't expect that here. This neighborhood, everybody knows each other.
Investigators were quick to announce that in addition to the arrests, they had uncovered a motivation. They stated that this had not been a spontaneous or random murder, but instead, one that had been well thought out and orchestrated by the suspects. Just the day after Seth had vanished, Kyle and Amber's mother, Tracy Wright, contacted police and informed them that her son had been a witness to Seth's murder, and that it had been committed at Charlie's home. Kyle agreed to come down to the police station, where he revealed what he knew about the murder. He said that on that Sunday, he, his sister Amber, Justin and Michael were at Charlie's home. The conversation turned to Seth, and Michael told the others how much he hated Seth. Michael's hatred had stemmed from Seth allegedly hitting Amber. Soon enough, the conversation turned to murder. The plan was for Amber and Charlie to lure Seth to Charlie's home on 53rd Avenue. Initially, Kyle claimed that he saw Michael shoot Seth before admitting that the entire group had planned the murder. When the group of teenagers were brought in for questioning, many of them confessed. Their confessions painted a disturbing picture of Seth's last moments on Earth. Charlie said that when Seth entered her home, Kyle, Justin, and Michael emerged from a spare bedroom and rushed towards Seth.
This happened at your house. At no time did you ever say, "What the hell are you doing? What's going on?"
Mike said that he wanted to shoot his ass.
You knew that he was coming. It wasn't like it was unannounced, correct?
I knew about it. Like, they didn't say he was going to kill him. He said all I wanted to do is scare him.
They started beating him with their fists before Kyle and Justin started smacking him across the head with a wooden axe handle. Charlie knew about the murder plan, yet claimed that she was overcome with fear and ran to her bedroom, where she stayed as the attack unfolded. She said that while she was in her bedroom, she heard a couple of gunshots, followed by a couple more gunshots. Amber's story matched Charlie's story.
Then what happens? Seth comes
to the house? Knocked on the door and Charlie answered it, and she was like, well, what do you want? And he was like, I just need to talk to Amber. Can I come in? She let him in.
Where was Kyle and Mike?
Kyle was in the living room.
Okay.
Mike was off in his room like he always is.
Okay.
And out of nowhere, we heard another door just fly open, and we just heard gunshot after gunshot after gunshot. I looked at Charlie. I was like, run. We ran to her room, went in her bathroom and shut the door. And then Mike went in the room and was like, if you say one word of what I did, I will have two more bodies.
Kyle told a similar story, but admitted that he had hit Seth as well.
I hit him over the head with a stick.
Who'd you hit?
Seth.
Okay.
And he was in the chair, and I got him in the kitchen. I said, now, get out. And then all of a sudden, I hear, bam, bam, bam. Mike sitting there laying bullets into me.
So you saw Mike Barger shoot Seth?
Yes, ma'am. And he grabbed the body, put it into the bathtub, and then he was talking about how he was going to burn it, and then there was a rock quarry over here by Gator Mountain or whatever, and he was going to dump the ashes or whatever into the rock quarry.
How many times did Mike shoot him?
I don't know. I heard eight.
He said that as soon as Seth entered the home, the three teenage boys attacked him before Michael shot him multiple times. Still clinging to life, Seth attempted to flee from the home. However, Justin grabbed a hold of him and struck him with an axe handle before restraining him. As Justin held Seth down, Michael shot him several more times. From here, Seth was dragged into the bathroom where Michael smashed his kneecaps so that he could fit his body into a sleeping bag. It was at this point that Michael noticed that Seth was still alive. He shot him once more in the bathtub. Seth was then hogtied and placed into a sleeping bag, which was dragged to the backyard by the group and burned in a fire pit for several hours. Following the murder, the group of teenagers cleaned the entire house with bleach and shoveled Seth's remains from the burn pit into several 5-gallon paint buckets. After the teenagers were all interviewed, Kyle, Amber, and Charlie were placed into an interrogation room together with no police officers, just to see if they would reveal any more information.
Just that thing was going all through my head about that man, just recapping everything, man.
Everything keeps replaying, like, if you could put my in memory on a TV, you could see everything.
We did not kill an innocent kid because this kid is not innocent. He threatened to burn my house, did kill my family. And he deserved for this time to went too far.
You know this is gonna be awful. You mean people are gonna hate us for this?
Why?
There's a 15-year-old kid murdered because of us.
Following this, they were informed that they were all being charged with first-degree murder.
Okay, this is the story. You're all going to be booked with first-degree premeditated murder. Take a deep breath.
Like, well, since we really did do anything.
No, see, but you did. But you did. Yeah. First of all, let's get over that hump right now, okay? That we really didn't do anything because everybody's complicit here. A person was murdered, okay? We all knew about it. We all planned it. Okay, let's man up to the fact that, damn it, this was a pretty heinous crime and we all had something to do with it.
I know, I was scared because Mike had a gun and I
was... Oh, you know what? Stop it. Do you think we haven't been listening to everything you guys have been saying in here? Are you that stupid, really? Just stop.
During his interrogation, James had admitted that he was aware of the murder plot and had gone to the home following the murder and helped Michael and Justin dispose of the remains and other evidence. He further admitted that he helped Michael and Justin evade capture, but it wasn't long before they too were arrested. Following the arrests, many people were left wondering what had actually transpired between the group of teenagers, and what the relationship dynamics between them were. The murder was exceptionally brutal, and as the investigators stated, it was unlike anything they had ever seen. Michael had moved from Michigan to Ocala around 3 years prior to live with his father and grandparents, and he soon enough started to hang out with Kyle and Amber, who were siblings. They soon introduced Michael to Charlie and Justin, who were living together in Charlie's house. Charlie was originally from Maryland, but in 2010, she met a man online and moved over to Florida and got married. However, towards the end of 2010, Charlie's husband was sent to jail and Charlie was left on her own. Plagued by loneliness, Charlie ended up opening her home to anybody who wanted to move in. Eventually, Michael moved in to Charlie's home. Michael had earlier charges of burglary and grand theft, and according to court records, a woman had sought an injunction against him to protect her son. According to Rosemary Dehan, Michael often told her that he heard voices inside his head. Then on one occasion in July of 2010, Michael chased Rosemary's son around their yard with an axe, threatening to kill him and his family. Rosemary had tried to obtain an injunction against Michael on behalf of her son, but citing insufficient evidence, the judge declined the restraining order. Rosemary would later say that she believed that Michael only wanted to be taken to a health center to make the voices in his head stop. Rosemary also said that Michael was often in need of a roof over his head. While he had lived with his father and grandparents, he had frequently been kicked out of the home. She described Michael as unloved and uncared about, and said that he was just wanting somebody to care about him or to give him attention. Michael's attorney on that case, Charles Holloman, spoke with the Associated Press and said that despite his criminal record, Michael did not have a violent track record. He said that he had typical scraps that many teenagers have, but said that there was nothing that rose to the level of what he had now been accused of. Many people who knew Michael shared in the disbelief. According to one neighbour, Michael had been given the nickname Daddy's Little Princess because he was a wimp. Amber had been arrested in May on a domestic violence battery charge, but the charge had been dropped. Justin had been arrested several times as a juvenile on charges including possession of a weapon on school property, aggravated battery, and burglary. Kyle, Charlie, and James had no criminal record. While Charlie had claimed that Michael wanted to kill Seth because he had hit Amber, it would be revealed that the motivation was much more complex. See, before the murder, Seth had been dating Amber. However, in March, Seth and Amber had broken up, and Amber started dating Michael. Facebook would reveal a growing feud between Amber and Michael and Seth. Over the course of several weeks, the conversations became more aggressive, with Seth writing on several occasions that Amber had cheated on him with Michael and that he wanted to fight Michael. During one conversation with a friend, Seth had accused Michael of chickening out of fighting him and referred to Amber as a dumb fucking trick. Amber then comes into the conversation and writes, "You're nothing but a huge fucking joke. All you know how to do is bitch talk and whine when you don't get what you want. Get over the fact I left you." In early April, Seth accused Amber of cheating on him with Michael and accused her of using drugs on Facebook. He posted, "Hello everybody, my name is Amber Wright and I smoke meth every day. I love the stuff. A number of friends replied, and Seth repeatedly threatened that he was going to beat up Michael. At one point in the conversation, Amber responds and defends herself. She denies cheating on Seth and said she broke up with him because she was tired of him throwing her into walls and was tired of him calling her names. Several days later, Amber posted on Facebook that she'd been having a bad day, and Seth responds with a peace offering, writing, "I'm just trying to stop all the drama. You don't need it, and neither do I." To which Amber replied, "Well, if you want to stop it, then don't talk to me. I want to be nice, but I can't talk to you. The thought of you makes me sick, so just leave me alone." Seth becomes angry and once again accuses Amber of using drugs. 6 days later, Seth would be dead. A friend of Seth's came forward and told investigators that on Sunday afternoon, Seth had received a text message from Amber stating that she wanted to rekindle their relationship and asked him to come over to Charlie's house so that they could speak. According to the friend, she sensed straight away that something was amiss. According to his friend, Brittany Jones, she told Seth that he shouldn't fall for that. In fact, Seth himself was a bit skeptical at first, and even texted Amber about his fears of being jumped.
He's like, "No, I probably won't." I was like, "Well, don't go home tonight." And he was like, I will. And then he came here anyways.
Sadly, Seth still really cared for Amber, and he genuinely wanted to start their relationship back up, despite the fact that she had hurt him in the past and he had hurt her. Seth ignored Amber's advice. Seth ignored Brittany's advice and drove over to the home where he would be killed. Investigators had been led to a water-filled lime rock pit where the paint buckets which contained Seth's remains were uncovered. They were sent to the University of Florida Department of Anthropology, which specializes in human identification. Meanwhile, investigators had returned to the crime scene looking for additional evidence. While many of the suspects had already confessed, and their confessions matched the evidence already found, DNA evidence needed to be collected, and the murder weapon had still not been found. One of the suspects had said that the gun had been hidden in an air conditioning vent in the trailer, but it had yet to be found. By this point, James had been released from jail on bond, and he told the media that while he knew about the murder plot, he never actually believed that the teenagers would go through with it. He stated that he was worried about his own future and said that he was looking at a lot of years in prison if he were convicted. As the community was trying to grasp what had happened, Charlie gave an interview from jail. She said that she felt sorry for Seth and that she was forced to participate in the murder because she was afraid. She said that a gun had been pointed to her head and she had been ordered to take part in the murder or she would have been murdered next. She also stated, "Words can't really say what I want to say. I can't put into words what I want to say to them in regards to Seth's parents." Seth's body was cremated and his ashes were given to his family. On the 24th of April, over 350 people gathered at the First Baptist Church of Summerfield to remember Seth during a funeral service. At the front of the church sat a table with pictures of Seth. Pastor Paul Howell urged the congregation not to dwell on what had happened, and instead, remember the good times they had with Seth. Shortly after the funeral, Circuit Judge David Eddy set the arraignment for the 6th of May. He appointed lawyers for each of the suspects, while prosecutors stated that they had not yet decided on whether to charge the teenagers as adults. Following the court appearance, Charlie's lawyer, Jonathan Bull, filed a motion wherein he claimed that his client was being crucified in the national media. He produced a number of publications to back up his motion, including a suggestion on the Dr. Drew show that Charlie was high on meth at the time of the murder. He said that these publications were baseless and he was concerned with how his client had been categorized. He had requested a gag order, but this would ultimately be turned down when the judge ruled in favor of transparency. When the teenagers appeared back in court on the 4th of May, they were all formally charged with first-degree murder. This meant that the cases against the two juveniles would be moved from juvenile court to adult court. If found guilty, they would all be facing adult sentences. In June, Michael appeared in court, where he waived his right to a speedy trial. During this court appearance, the prosecution stated that they had not yet decided whether they would be seeking the death penalty against Michael. They also hadn't decided whether they would be seeking the death penalty against Justin, but had decided against seeking it for Charlie. The rest of the defendants would follow suit and waive their right to a speedy trial, except for Charlie, who chose not to waive her right to a speedy trial. This meant that the state must bring their case against her within 174 days of her April arrest. Her lawyer stated, "I believe it is in my client's best interest if we aggressively defend the case instead of letting it stretch out. After reviewing discovery extensively, I feel, as we are right now, we can get the case ready before a jury by a September trial date." He stated that his client was maintaining her innocence and that she had been forced to take part in Seth's murder. Towards the end of June, Seth's family publicly made a statement about the murder for the very first time. They wrote a letter to the Star Banner in which they said that the loss of Seth had been so overwhelming that they hadn't been able to speak about it. They said that Seth was not an abuser or a bully, referring to the rumour that Seth had hit Amber. They said that he loved to make people laugh and would have stood up for anybody who was being laughed at. They asked the public for patience, but also expressed thanks for the caring concern, love and support, not only from people in the area, but from people across the world. In early July, the state's attorney's office announced that they would be seeking the death penalty against Michael. Free Lunch Coffee is an amazing company on a mission to end hunger and malnutrition from the life of young children. And I'm lucky that they've sponsored this episode of Morbidology. Free Lunch Coffee are a Seattle, Washington-based coffee company, and they give away 50% of their proceeds to the Lunchbox Fund. The Lunchbox Fund have served over 5.6 million meals to 30,000 schoolchildren in South Africa in 2019 alone, and extended their national reach by 17%, adding 4,500 new learners to the program. Free Lunch Coffee offer freshly roasted, specialty grade coffee, USDA organic certified coffee, fair trade certified coffee, and single origin coffee from Peru. They offer 100% money back guarantee for 30 days. So head on over to freelunchcoffee.com or click the link in my show notes and enter promo code COMPASSION for 10% off your order. Remember that 50% of what they earn helps to feed children, so why not drink some good coffee and help starving children? In September, Charlie was the first of the group of teenagers to stand trial on first-degree murder charges. Her lawyer had unsuccessfully tried to get the trial moved. During opening statements, both the prosecution and the defense described Charlie as a young woman who, in the months leading up to the murder, had desperately tried to keep her rent paid and had been staving off loneliness following the arrest of her husband. Her situation led Charlie opening up her home to a number of people, including Justin and Michael. During the prosecution's opening statements, they said that Charlie was an active player in Seth's murder. Assistant State Attorney Amy Burnt portrayed Charlie as a woman who tried to cover up the murder, and at one point during police interviews, even admitted that she was involved in the plot to kill Seth. She additionally said that Charlie's version of events that night had frequently changed. According to Deputy David Graham, when he interviewed Charlie when Seth was reported missing, he testified that she kept changing her accounts. He said that first of all, Charlie said that she had heard that Seth had been shot, before saying she heard that he had been shot at, before saying that she heard a firecracker sound. Eventually, Charlie admitted that she and Amber had lured Seth to her home, knowing fully well that he was going to be murdered.
So basically, your role and Amber's role was to get Seth to the house, knowing that Mike was going to kill him when he got to the house. Is that correct?
I mean, yeah.
During the defense's opening statements, attorney Jonathan Bull stated that Charlie was nothing more than an unwitting pawn. He claimed that there was no evidence to directly link Charlie to the murder, nor any evidence she knew that Seth was going to be killed that night. He also claimed that when the attack unfolded, both Charlie and Amber locked themselves in the bedroom, and that Michael had held Charlie at gunpoint at least twice during the attack on Seth and during the disposal of his body. Early on in the trial, a video recording of Charlie being interviewed by Detective Donald Bew was presented. Charlie is clearly nervous in the video and tries to joke with the detective while speaking about what happened on the night of Seth's murder. Her voice quivers with emotion as she claims that Michael threatened her and said that if she told anybody about what had happened, he would kill her. She broke down at one point as she describes how Michael said he wanted to kill Seth. During Charlie's initial version of events, she left out major parts of the killing, including the beating of Seth and the burning of his body in a fire pit behind her home. She claimed that she and Amber ran into the bedroom and locked the door, and at one point, Michael threatened them both with a gun and ordered them to stay in the bedroom or they too would get killed. She said that they stayed there the entire night, eventually falling asleep. However, there was one eyewitness who refuted this. Julie Cunningham, who was Charlie's neighbour, testified that on the night of the murder, at around 11 p.m, she and her husband had become concerned by the large bonfire that was burning in Charlie's yard. She said that they went over to see what was going on, and Charlie was there. She said that Charlie was extremely friendly and bubbly, as she explained that she had just invited a few friends over for a bonfire. While she wasn't able to identify the two men that were with Charlie, she said that one of them, possibly Justin, had his chest puffed out in an intimidating manner. During the interview, Charlie had also initially denied that Justin was there, before later acknowledging that he had been there and had participated in the murder. Charlie claimed that she believed that Michael was only going to beat Seth for allegedly hitting Amber. The detective pressed Charlie for more information before she finally confessed that she knew that Michael was going to kill Seth that night, but she said that she didn't believe that it would actually happen. She stated, "I didn't know Mike was serious." She would later confess that she knew the chances of Seth leaving her home that night alive were nil. Seth's mother, Sonia, took the jury through the bad blood between Seth and Michael. As she wiped tears from her eyes, she said that the conflict between the two had gotten so bad that at one time they had a massive argument in front of Seth's home. Sonia said that she had never met Charlie and had never even heard of her until she was arrested in connection with her son's murder. Next up was Kathleen Schmidt, a crime scene technician. She showed photographs of Charlie's unkempt house, where 22 caliber ammunition and shell casings were discovered. She testified that there were several areas in the bathroom which showed the presence of blood. She further testified that in the fire pit behind Charlie's home, they found 5 deformed lead fragments, resembling bullets, as well as numerous fragments that looked like bone. Michael Warren, head of the C.A. Pound Human Identification Laboratory at the University of Florida, testified that the fragments were indeed bones. Over 100 bone fragments had been found in the fire pit and had been scattered around randomly. He said that the evidence showed that the fire had been tended and stirred. He further testified that 5 buckets contained more burned bones and charred portions of internal organs. Dr. Kyle Shaw, associate medical examiner at the District 5 Medical Examiner's Office, told the jury that burned parts of Seth's heart, kidney, and liver were recovered. Kayla Fitzgerald, a DNA forensic technician for the Marion County Sheriff's Office, testified that she had collected blood from numerous items, including a towel in Charlie's bedroom. However, Nicole Lee, an analyst from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement Laboratory, said that the blood sample was not sufficient to extract a DNA profile. The only blood that matched Charlie's was found in a mixture in the bathroom where Seth was murdered, but the sample was a mixture from Charlie and an unknown person. None of the other blood samples from inside the bathroom produced any leads. The only blood sample that matched Seth was found in the living room of the home, and the sample showed a mixture of Seth's blood and Kyle's blood. A number of Charlie's friends were called to testify, and they revealed that when Michael moved in to Charlie's home, they stopped visiting. They described how Michael often flaunted the fact that he had a gun. As Christian Samelot said, it was around his waist or on Charlie's windowsill. I didn't like him, so I stayed away. Crystal Anderson was also called to testify. Michael had dated Crystal's daughter for around 6 months.
Himself shot him.
In the yard?
In the yard, multiple times. I said, have you done something crazy? And he said yes. He had drug him back in the house, placed him in the bathtub, and had beat him some more and shot him twice in the face. He said that they had placed it in a sleeping bag and built a fire. Can I have a moment, please?
Crystal told the jury that Michael had fled to her home after the murder and had confessed that he had beaten, shot, and then burned Seth. When questioned why she did not phone police right away, Crystal claimed that she was scared. After all of the testimony was presented, the jury was sent away to deliberate. They deliberated for just over 1 hour before reaching a verdict. They found Charlie Ely guilty of first-degree murder. As the verdict was read out, Charlie burst into tears. Later, one of the jurors stated that it was Charlie's recorded interview with the detective that essentially sealed her fate. The juror, who asked not to be named, said, "The interrogation, where she actually admitted knowing Seth's killing was going to happen, that was pretty much it. There were other things, but that was the main thing." Under Florida law, life without parole is the mandatory sentence for a first-degree murder conviction. Before the life sentence was imposed by the judge, Seth's mother addressed Charlie. She said, "Some say your life is over, but you will still see and talk to your family. You will still get letters and birthday cards. You will still laugh and cry. I have no sympathy for the tears you shed. They have not been for Seth, but rather for what's happening to you. You could have been a hero and saved many lives." In the January following Charlie's trial, it was announced that Kyle and Amber would be standing trial together, but with dual juries, which is something that very rarely happens. Prosecutors had stated that the evidence against the siblings was virtually identical, and that a single trial would save time and money, as well as be more efficient. In May, Justin pleaded guilty to first-degree murder. He was automatically handed a life sentence. His plea had come as an avoidance of a potential death sentence. Then in early June, the murder trial of Kyle and Amber began. During opening statements, Assistant State Attorney Amy Burnt recounted the details of the night of Seth's murder and outlined the evidence that they would be presenting. She said, "A group of five people who hated Seth Jackson got together and said tonight is the night that Seth dies, and they put together a plan to murder him." She said that there was evidence that both Kyle and Amber were involved in the murder and cited their collective hatred of Seth. She said that Amber had lured Seth to the home, knowing fully that he would be killed when he arrived, and said that Kyle had used a door frame to hit Seth and then helped start the fire. She told the jury that Kyle had admitted all of this to investigators. In his opening statements, Kyle's lawyer, David Mengers, placed all of the blame on Michael. He said that Kyle wasn't aware that the murder plot was serious. He said that Kyle was remorseful for his actions and regretted what had happened. Turning to the jury, he said, "This 16-year-old boy, Kyle Hooper, is not guilty of the sins of Michael Bargo." Several witnesses testified about seeing the bonfire at the back of Charlie's home on the night of Seth's murder. One of the witnesses said that he saw two of three boys chase another boy out of Charlie's home, beat him in the front yard, and then drag him back into the home. However, he said that he could not identify them because he had not been wearing his glasses. Another witness said that he had seen Amber and Michael sitting alongside the bonfire that night. William Samalot, one of Seth's friends, said that Seth and Amber had been texting each other on the night of the murder while they had been walking to a friend's house in the neighbourhood. He said that when they parted ways, Seth said that he was going home, but evidently he was going to Charlie's house, where he believed he was meeting Amber. Following the eyewitness testimony, forensic evidence was presented, and it was the same evidence which had been presented during Charlie's trial. While there was no direct evidence to tie either Kyle or Amber to the murder, videotaped confessions were shown where both Kyle and Amber admitted to their roles. Kyle took to the witness stand where he made another full confession.
"And you helped drag him back in the house after Seth tried to escape?"
"Yes, ma'am."
He said that he, Amber, Michael, Justin, and Charlie were at Charlie's house when they decided they were going to kill Seth. He detailed that they all had a role to play in the murder. His role was to hit Seth over the head with a piece of wood from a doorframe, while Amber's role was to lure Seth to the house. On the witness stand, Kyle admitted, "I did intend to hurt him." He said that Seth was shot, but then escaped outside, where he was beaten and dragged back inside. Under cross-examination, Kyle admitted that he and Michael hated Seth, and that Michael's anger grew because he was jealous that Seth had dated Amber and had allegedly abused her. He said that Seth had pushed Amber before and had spit on her face, and that he had heard from other friends about other episodes of abuse. Kyle also admitted that Seth had been involved with a girl that he had liked, and that a week before the murder, he had seen Seth and this girl together at her house. Kyle's testimony was the last in the 5-day trial.
I don't know how it feels for to have your son to be lost. I don't. But And I could only imagine how hard it could be for you. And I know if it were me, I know how my family would feel. And I know it may not help or bring him back in any way. But I am sorry for what I have done.
During closing arguments, Assistant State Attorney Amy Burnt said that the murder would never have happened if Amber had not lured Seth to the house. She said that the state had met its burden in proving that Kyle and Amber were both principals to first-degree murder. The jury ultimately sided with the prosecution and found both Kyle Hooper and Amber Wright guilty of first-degree murder. During the sentencing phase, Seth's mother, Sonia, read out two letters that she had written to Kyle and Amber. The first one read, "Amber, we hope that guilt eats you inside and out, knowing that you caused all of this. Seth would never have been at that house without your manipulation." She had written something similar in her letter to Kyle, who had been friends with Seth at one point in time. It read in part, "I will never understand how someone that was supposed to be Seth's friend exhibited hatred towards him." They were both sentenced to life in prison. As Judge David Eddy handed down the sentences, he said, "This case is the single most cold, calculated, premeditated case of murder that I have ever seen. The only true sentence in this case, the only just sentence in this case, is a life sentence." Following the verdict, the last person to stand trial was Michael, the alleged ringleader. In late July, Michael spoke publicly for the first time since the murder and complained that he had been targeted for abuse by other inmates and corrections officers. He claimed that officers had spat in his food and had tried to humiliate him by reading letters from his loved ones aloud, causing other inmates to make fun of him. He also alleged that officers allowed an inmate into the recreation yard to beat him, leaving him with 10 stitches over his right eye. Marion County Jail strongly refuted this, and even Michael's own lawyer categorized the troubles he was facing as minor. During the interview, Michael refused to discuss the case or even the events that led to the murder. Instead, he said he wanted the world to know that he was not the monster that he had been portrayed as in the media, and even stated that he was innocent. According to jail officials, Michael hadn't been a model prisoner. He had been in trouble 6 times and had been cited for violating 14 rules and regulations, mostly for disruptions and disobeying orders. He had also received a citation for fighting and had received a disciplinary for making a shank out of a broken glasses lens. In fact, Michael had spent 5 months in disciplinary confinement. As Michael's defense team and the prosecution were preparing for trial, a judge ruled that James, who had been charged as an accessory, was not legally competent to stand trial. He was ordered to undergo treatment. Meanwhile, Michael's trial was pushed back until August of 2013. His defense lawyers wanted a PET scan to be performed on Michael, which is a scan used to reveal how somebody's tissues and organs are functioning. According to Robert Berland, a psychiatrist who evaluated Michael, he believed that he had a psychotic disturbance for many years. He believed that Michael was severely mentally ill and was prone to bouts of delusional and paranoid thinking, which had been brought on by a severe brain injury. Michael had been hit in the head with a brick during a fight when he was 14 or 15 years old, and had fallen off the roof of a house at 12 years old. The update was a setback for the prosecution, who said that they were already ready to head to trial. On the 12th of August, Michael's first-degree murder trial began. During opening statements, defense attorney Charles Holloman said, What you're going to learn is this. Michael Bargo is no mastermind. He was a Johnny-come-lately on this, and because of that, he will not be guilty of first-degree murder. He told the jury that the case would be one of reasonable doubt, and said that Michael would be testifying on his own behalf as to what actually happened on the night that Seth was murdered. He said that despite several confessions that Michael had made, there was no real confession. He put forward the theory that the ringleader was actually Kyle, not Michael. Assistant State Attorney Amy Burnt countered this during her opening statements and said, Michael Bargo, the defendant in this case, wanted 15-year-old Seth Jackson to die. It was April 17, 2011, and he got four people to help him put together a well-thought-out, calculated, premeditated murder to lure Seth Jackson to the house where he would eventually be killed. She briefly took the jury through the facts of the case before stating that the day after the murder, Michael had found Seth's skull in the fire pit and had used pliers to pull out his teeth. Seth's mother, Sonia, once again testified. She told the jury that a week before the murder, Seth had been outside playing basketball when a red pickup truck pulled up and Michael jumped out. She heard her son yelling at Michael to get off his property and heard Michael shout, I have a bullet with your name on it. Seth's friend, William Samalot, also testified in regards to the bad blood between Michael and Seth. He said that Michael and Amber had gotten drunk and Amber had cheated on Seth. He said that the breakup was extremely hard on Seth. Under cross-examination, defense Holloman reminded William that Kyle had a crush on Melissa Masters, who had a crush on Seth. He suggested that this had created bad blood between Kyle and Seth. While some of the killers had claimed that Seth had been abusive towards Amber during their relationship, Judge David Eddy did not allow William to testify in regards to this and defend his friend. Another witness, Megan Albany, had stayed in Charlie's house with Michael and the other teenagers. She described how drugs and alcohol flowed freely in the house and that she had left around a week before the murder had taken place. She told the jury that Michael had a gun that he would either keep with him or keep in a chair or windowsill. She recalled watching him shoot out of the window at a tree. She said that at one point, an altercation took place between Michael and her cousin. When she attempted to step in the middle to stop the altercation, Michael pulled the gun on her. Michael's attorney pointed out that Michael didn't pull the trigger and suggested that he was under the influence of alcohol or drugs at the time. Her testimony was followed by Kristen Williams, an ex-girlfriend of Michael. She told the courtroom how the day after Seth's murder, Michael contacted her and said that he needed a place to stay. She agreed to let him come and stay with her and said that Michael had told her that there had been a fight that went bad and they ended up shooting the kid, dismembering his body, burning him, and then dumping his remains in a rock quarry. According to Kristen, Michael had confessed that he had been the one to pull the trigger. Under cross-examination, attorney Holloman pointed out that Kristen had initially lied to investigators about her knowledge of the case. She admitted that she had lied because she didn't believe Michael and didn't want to believe Michael. Kristen wasn't the only person that Michael allegedly confessed to. While in the Marion County Jail, William Faulkner had shared a cell with Michael. This was immediately after Michael's arrest. He noticed that Michael's face was discolored, and he asked why.
Okay, and what did he tell you happened to his face?
He just said, well, when I was burning that kid Seth's body, you know, I threw a paint can in, and it blew up my face.
Michael had allegedly told William that Seth had raped Amber and went on to explain more details of the murder.
He said he hit him over the back of the head with a 2x4, and then they lifted him up, put him in a recliner, and then started basically, you know, talking trash to him, and Then he said when he was tired of it, you know, he pulled out a gun, just shot him 3 times in the recliner. So I guess they took the body from the bathtub once he was dead and bring him outside behind the house, and that's where they tried to burn the body.
Under cross-examination, attorney Holloman pointed out that William had not come forward with what Michael had told him until May of 2011. His testimony was followed by James William, who also testified that Michael had confessed to shooting Seth around 8 times.
He told us that he had shot and killed a boy.
James Havens, who was still considered incompetent to stand trial, was also called to testify during Michael's trial. He said that he had been at Charlie's house before the murder, but had left when the teenagers started talking about killing Seth.
Did you hear Michael Bargo say anything to the group about wanting to kill Seth Jackson?
Yeah.
He said that later on that night, Michael had called him and simply said, "The deed is done." He confessed that he took Michael and Justin to the back of a lime rock pit and watched as they hauled paint buckets, cinder blocks, and cable into the quarry. The same forensic evidence as the earlier trials was also presented. Forensic experts testified that they had discovered a tooth, human tissue, and other charred remains of Seth at the quarry. A piece of skull and other facial components were consistent with DNA which had been taken from Seth's parents. The remains had been determined to come from a male between the ages of 14 and 16. Dr. Kyle Shaw, the medical examiner, testified that the cause of death was gunshot wound or wounds and blunt force trauma. After the prosecution rested their case, the defense called on Michael to testify on his own behalf. Michael attempted to place the blame on Kyle. He said that on the day of the murder, Kyle was angry because he believed that Seth had slept with a girl that he liked. He said, "I know how Kyle can get. He's real short-tempered. He's pissed because his girlfriend left him." He claimed that somebody had stolen his gun, which had been used to kill Seth. In fact, he claimed that he wasn't even there when the murder had taken place. He said that he had returned home that night to find the group of teenagers around the bonfire in the backyard, and the home smelling of bleach. He claimed that he had helped dispose of the remains, telling the jury, "I didn't know what to do. I freaked out." He further claimed that the others had conspired to place the blame on him, but said that it was Kyle who had told him that he was either with the group or against the group. He stated, "I was actually scared for my life. Here I am, all beat up, drunk, high, all kinds of messed up. I couldn't fight off a pee. I'm liable to be the next one in the fire pit." On the witness stand, Michael appeared to be confident, and while he tried to distance himself from the murderer, he showed absolutely no compassion or sympathy for what had happened to Seth. In fact, he summed up his overall opinion of Seth by stating, "I just didn't like the person." He hinted that Seth had abused Amber, but this was not admissible in court.
"Because you were sleeping with Amber and dating her at the time."
"No, I wasn't."
"You do have her initials tattooed right in your groin area."
"I have
it
on my thigh."
"No, overruled."
"I have it on my thigh, I do."
"Okay. Do you tattoo a lot of girls' names that you're friends with all over your thighs?"
"No, but there was something behind that. If you want me to tell you, I will tell you."
"How about this? She has your initials tattooed on her private area too, doesn't she?"
"Not in her private area. It's more of a belt line, but yeah."
"Okay. Well, look, some people may say that's your private area. You don't. That's fine. Right here."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Okay. Did you do that yourself?"
"I did."
"Okay. So you tattooed your initials right here on Amber Wright."
"I can't see where you're pointing."
"Right here."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Okay. And then you have her initials tattooed right here."
"Where?"
"Right here."
"Yeah, right here."
"Okay. But you weren't in love with her or sleeping with her?"
"No."
"In fact, isn't it true that the reason you and Seth were feuding is because she cheated on Seth with you?"
"She never cheated. on Seth with me. She never did anything with me.
And you've come in here now and you've made up this story about Seth raping her and Seth beating her when that was not the reason you guys were fighting at all.
Never made up the story. I never told you something that I didn't already hear from her.
Because isn't it true that Seth broke up with Amber because she found out that you two had slept together?
Not to my understanding. You want me to answer that?
You already did.
No. Let me give you half answers. If you want a full answer, I'll give you a full answer.
You may.
So my understanding of what happened was she called to break up with him because he was abusive. And I've never slept with Amber. Okay.
So somehow again, you're just a misunderstood victim in this whole thing.
Somehow I got dragged in the middle of it.
Right. Your nose is broken.
Right.
You're beat up.
Right.
Badly.
Pretty bad.
And you describe yourself as lying in the fetal position when Kyle was just kicking you.
Coming in the days.
Testify on direct, you told them to throw the buckets over the cliff, down the rock wall.
So they're going to do it. That'd be the way to do it.
You were helping them out. You were taking Kyle's advice if you were going to be with them. Then after you dispose of Seth's body, after it's dumped in the quarry, you go to Publix, get some beer, and start drinking.
Yeah. Pretty stressful.
He also claimed that he was never actually dating Amber, despite the fact that everybody said they were dating. Their Facebooks indicated they were dating, and they had each other's initials tattooed. He said that when Seth began threatening him, he didn't get involved, stating, "I avoid problems as much as possible. I've been picked on my whole life. I'm a little guy." In closing arguments, the prosecution once again stated that the murder was premeditated and that Michael had convinced Amber to lure Seth to the home. Prosecutor Burnt said, "Michael Bargo wanted Seth Jackson dead. He planned out this murder and he carried it out." Michael's attorney conceded that Michael was not an innocent man. He stated that Michael was guilty of second-degree murder, but said that the state had failed to prove premeditation. After 3 hours of deliberation, the jury reached a verdict. They found Michael Bargo guilty of first-degree murder. The second phase of the trial was to follow, wherein the state would be presenting testimony in support of a death sentence for Michael, while his defense would desperately try to save his life. The state would be arguing that there were two aggravating factors in the case that warranted a death sentence, and those were that the murder was heinous, atrocious, and cruel, and that it was cold, calculated, and premeditated. For a death penalty recommendation, the jury would need to find that the state had proved one of these factors beyond a reasonable doubt. During the sentencing phase, Michael would once again take to the witness stand. He detailed that his life was spinning out of control just before the murder and spoke about the depression he felt throughout his childhood. He said that as a child, he had been traumatized by his parents' divorce and had been abused by his mother, something that his grandmother, Virgie Waller, would corroborate. They both said that Michael had been beaten by his mother throughout his childhood, and as a way to cope, Michael turned to alcohol. Virgie said that on one occasion she saw an imprint of Michael's mother's hand on his skin and that she would hit him in the back, legs and shoulders and would punch him in places where the marks could not be seen. Eventually, the Department of Children and Families got involved and Michael's parents were ordered to undergo counselling. While Michael's mother, Tracy O'Brien, had not appeared at all during his murder trial, she would testify during the sentencing phase. When she took to the witness stand, she said that she had not seen her son in 4 years and placed the blame solely on his father, Michael Sr. She said that Michael Sr. had a drinking problem and was always angry.
How would you describe his drinking?
Daily. It was a normal thing.
But how would he act when he was drinking?
Angry. He would explode for no reason over little things.
Did he work?
When he wanted to. He had his own business pressure cleaning.
What hours would he normally work? Or were there normal hours?
There weren't normal hours.
What about him coming home in the evenings?
It was normal for him to come home late at night.
What kind of mood would he be when he came home late at night?
He was usually drinking when he came home. So he was angry.
Well, what was he angry about, do you know?
Any little thing would set him off. He would throw dinner if it wasn't warm, or if I said something wrong, or if we got into an argument, he would start throwing things.
Well, what other kind of manifestations, what other form would this aggressiveness take, other than throwing objects?
He punched holes in walls. He broke out a car window when Michael was a baby in the back seat.
Tell me about that. There was a night he didn't come home.
And I knew where he was. He was at the bar that he always stopped at. And we had a friend staying with us. I didn't have a vehicle at the time, so he drove me up to where I knew he was. And I went in, and Mike Sr. and his mom were sitting at the bar. I don't remember what I said. I said something to him. I turned around, I walked away. And he followed me out to the car, and he punched out the window. And Michael is in the back seat, in his car seat. Not even a year old, and was full of glass.
Evidence was also presented from a brain imaging expert who said that Michael most likely had an abnormal brain, which makes it difficult for him to control his impulses and urges. Dr. Joseph Wu testified that one area of Michael's brain was higher functioning than a normal brain. He said that Michael had periods where he would become depressed and would start to have hallucinations. Under cross-examination, Assistant State Attorney Robin Arnold pointed out that the testing on Michael had been done when he was 21, not in 2011, when the murder was committed. Another doctor, Dr. Robert Berland, said that Michael was originally diagnosed with bipolar disorder, but said that this was a throwaway diagnosis, and expressed his belief that Michael was most likely schizoaffective. He said that this was essentially the same thing, but was inheritive. Michael's grandfather had a history of mental illness, which resulted in numerous hospital visits, before he eventually ended his own life. Dr. Berland concluded by saying that Michael Sr. was also very likely to be mentally ill, and that Michael Jr. also showed symptoms of psychosis and delusional paranoid thinking. The prosecution would present their own experts, who would refute these findings. Dr. Greg Pritchard said that he believed that Michael's behaviour was on the cusp of psychopathic, and that he had been previously described by medical professionals as oppositional, defiant. He pointed towards his history of insubordination, fighting, and being suspended from different schools 20 times, setting fires and showing disrespect to authority figures as well as the women in his life. Dr. Pritchard said that these factors all pertained more so to behavioural problems as opposed to psychosis. After all of the testimony was heard, Michael was given the opportunity to speak, and he shared his thoughts on potentially being sentenced to death, even though he's only lived a short while. He said, "I never had a house, never had a car, never been married, never had kids. You're about to take something from me that I've never even had." The jury now had to decide whether to sentence Michael to death or whether to sentence him to life in prison. It took them just 6 hours to reach a verdict.
Of the jury by a vote of 10-2, advise and recommend to the court that it impose the death penalty upon Michael Shane Bargo Jr.
They decided that Michael Bargo deserved to die for his part in Seth Jackson's murder. As the verdict was read out, Michael showed no emotion. Now, it was up to Circuit Judge David Eddy to decide whether he agreed with their verdict, or whether he wanted to sentence Michael to life in prison. Judge David Eddy would ultimately sentence Michael Bargo to death. As he was led from court, his father called out that he loved him. Michael had just become the youngest person on Florida's death row. Outside of court, Sonia said, "We finally got justice for our son. Michael made his choice when he took Seth's life. He decided his own fate." In May of 2014, Amber was granted a new trial after an appeals court found that one of the interviews that she had given to investigators should not have been used in her original trial because they violated her rights, because she had not been advised of her Miranda rights. Shortly thereafter, Kyle's life sentence was thrown out. Under new U.S. Supreme Court rulings, a new sentence was required. The ruling prohibited a sentencing protocol that mandates life without parole possibilities for people who were juveniles when they committed their crime. Now, a judge has to listen to mitigating circumstances and the nature of their crime before sentencing juveniles to life in prison without parole. In 2016, Amber would be found guilty of first-degree murder a second time. She was once again sentenced to life in prison. Many people, understandably, viewed Amber as the catalyst to the murder. After all, Seth would never have gone to that home if Amber did not lure him there under the pretense of a reconciliation. Kyle would also be sentenced a second time to life in prison. Then in June of 2020, Charlie Ely was released from prison.
I'm not a bad person. I'm really not. It's just a thing that, it's another thing with hanging out with the wrong crowd. I mean, in high school, you know, like, you're always told that you're gonna, your parents are telling you you need to hang out with the right people. Well, this is a good idea. You never give in to peer pressure. If you feel like something's gonna happen, you need to call the police. You need to call for help.
For years, she had argued of ineffective counsel during trial, and a judge had agreed. In light of the federal ruling, Charlie had been eligible for a new trial. However, she was able to enter a plea for the lesser charge of second-degree murder and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. She had accrued credit for time served in jail and prison and was immediately released. Outside of court, her lawyer said that the case was a reminder for people to choose their friends wisely.
Words cannot describe the pain and suffering you have inflicted on our family. You have taken so much from so many. The loss of our son has been the most difficult thing we have ever had to bear. It has changed our lives and the way we think, feel, and live. Our lives will never be the same, as we will never see our son grow up or have children of his own. Nor will we ever spend another birthday or a holiday with our son. As I stand here today, or sit, facing children who have taken our son's life, I ask myself, they are just kids. Is life in prison the right punishment for them? The hours before any action was taken proves the kind of person they really are. They had plenty of time to think about what was going to happen. The thoughts running through their minds should have raised red flags. They say their minds are not fully developed at this age. This is true, but it does not take a fully developed mind to know and understand right from wrong.
Young love can very often be all-consuming for teenagers. You're at that age where you're trying to find yourself, and you can behave in extremely irrational ways. That can often just be part of growing up. The relationship between Seth and Amber, and then Michael and Amber, stirred up some powerful emotions, and they found themselves turning to the internet to put each other on blast. The grim murder of Seth Jackson was the culmination of what happens when beef on the internet enters real life. The moment that Seth was lured to that home was the moment that the lives of multiple teenagers were shattered in ways that could never be repaired. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I already said it at the start, but once again, a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, as well as my old Patreon supporters. The support on Patreon truly helps out in defraying the costs of freedom of information requests, archive subscriptions, hosting, and much more. So if you'd like to support the show in return for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus and much more, check out Morbidology on Patreon. A big massive thank you to everybody who has simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode, followed me on social media, sent me a message. All of the support is very much appreciated. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo of the amazing true crime podcast, Murderific. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Maine, the northernmost state in America, usually thought of as a quaint, safe vacation destination. Our motto is, the way life should be. But did you know serial killer John Joseph Joubert was raised in Maine and was convicted of 3 stabbing murders of young boys? Or the unsolved abduction of baby girl Ayla Reynolds, supposedly stolen from her bed near Christmas 2011. Her body has never been found. These are just 2 of the Maine stories Murderific has covered. We cover crimes from all areas and Maine cases as well. Murderific True Crime Podcast, hosted by me, Bernadette, can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or go to murderific.com. We will be executing podcasts one crime at a time.